Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
Welcome to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Tumalo. This podcast is brought to you all in the fundraising space, be you leadership, a gift officer or board member, and it's designed to bring you the latest thought leaders in our industry to challenge you to think differently, which is a big part of our job as fundraising consultants, is to get you to think in a different way. And I'm really excited to have our guest today. She and I have a background, similar background in sales. And I know people have told me for years, selling is not fundraising. Well, that's semantics. And I am convinced and will maintain that the skill sets, the mindset, the disciplines of a great salesperson are the same skill sets, mindsets, and disciplines of a great fundraiser. And obviously, everyone is working really hard in the fundraising space. I see it with my clients all the time, working long hours under a lot of pressure to bring in a lot of money. And it's often easy to just go on automatic pilot and to just look for a warm body with a heartbeat and a wallet.
We used to just say a pulse and an address.
And a wallet.
And a wallet.
Yeah. And that is Ellen Bristol that you're hearing there. Ellen, welcome. Thanks for being a part of this.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. And so Ellen and I were connected recently with some mutual acquaintances that we have in the industry. And again, you're a former salesperson like me.
Mm-hmm.
And you were selling big computer systems, yes?
Yeah, I was selling multi-million dollar computer systems back in the day before we were all using our phones and PCs. And they were big, expensive, complex purchases. And I liken them very much. I liken the process very much to securing major and transformational gifts. Because there are a lot of decision makers, a lot of decision influencers, a lot of zeros on the check and commas, and the decision process was lengthy. And to everybody's surprise, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, when you're making a big investment, be it a philanthropic investment or a business investment, your emotions get tied up in it. Is it going to work? Am I going to fail? Am I going to look bad if I approve this decision? Am I going to look worse if I don't approve this decision? You get it.
Yeah. Now, you're saying from the donor perspective or the fundraisers or both?
I was saying that primarily from the sales perspective, but I think it works 100% from both the donor's perspective and the gift officer's perspective.
Yeah. We need to have empathy for the donor.
But we also need to have empathy for ourselves and an appreciation of what the donor's investment means to the achievement of our organization's mission. And both of those things need to be taken into account simultaneously.
Yes.
I mean, it's like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and that old cliche. She had to do the same things he had to do, but backwards and in heels.
Right. Now, for our younger audience, you have a more current.
Oh, dear me.
Jennifer Lopez.
Go watch Dancing So You Think You Can Dance.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good quote, though. So, Ellen, you are president of Bristol Strategy Group.
Correct.
You are the author of a couple books.
Correct.
And I have your latest bestseller here on my desk, Fundraising the Smart Way, and published by Wiley Press. And we were saying earlier before we started the podcast, it's not easy to get Wiley to publish your book, and they have high standards.
I feel extremely privileged to have gotten that opportunity. And it was in the year that they accepted my proposal, it was the only proposal recommended to Wiley by AFP's publishing committee. So that book is a part of the AFP Wiley development series. And I loved writing every single word of it.
Yeah, and if I may share, I'm going to share it anyway.
Yeah, go ahead.
We can always edit it out. But you asked me before the call, before the podcast, did I enjoy the book? And I said, well, I'm always very candid, transparent with people.
Right.
Especially those that I care about and respect. And I said, enjoy is not the right word. And that's a compliment because it's not, you know, I'm not reading a book on guitars. I'm reading something that's really, you know, so what was the word? I didn't say enjoyable. I said helpful and challenging. And because it's packed with real practical, there's a lot here, a lot to unpack, but it's really practical. You're almost giving away, not to get too far off track, but I want to ask you a question because my dear friend, Brian Sagristano, the founder of our company, has done a couple of Wiley books. And at one point when I started working with him, I'm like, dude, you're giving it all away. Why would people hire us? It's all in the book. Did anybody ever ask you that?
Yeah, especially because Wiley recommended that we put up a companion website. So not only is the methodology, which PS happens to be called Fundraising the Smart Way, not only is the methodology explained in this book, but the templates for executing the methodology are also in the book. And here, I'll give you two reasons why you give it away. One is, excuse my self-aggrandizement here, but I've always felt since I started my practice 24 years ago, soon to be 25, that this model was so powerful and beneficial to the nonprofit sector that it deserved to be spread widely and made accessible to anybody who could borrow it from a library or, you know, shell out the bucks to get the Kindle version. And the other reason is I wanted to whet the appetites because they're of our sector. Because there are some concepts here that make sense on the page, but when you come to attempt to implement them, it might not be quite as simple. And if I can just continue for a moment.
Please.
Fundraising the Smart Way is what's called a methodology. In formal terms, a methodology is a set of guidelines, performance indicators, business rules, reporting methods, and other disciplines designed to consistently achieve a specific end. And methodologies are easy to read about, but they're not that easy to implement. A lot of our audience has heard of methodologies like Six Sigma and Lean, and its grandfather, Total Quality Management. And these are coin of the realm, everyday management practices used in high-performing for-profit organizations. And you can go to school and, you know, get a black belt degree in Six Sigma. We don't have disciplines like that in the nonprofit sector, and we'd benefit if we did. I hope that's provocative enough.
Well, yeah, you don't understand. We're too busy, Ellen. We don't have time.
Well, yes, dear.
Resources for all this, right?
Here, let me give you a graham cracker, pat you on the head, and ask you to sit down and be quiet for 10 minutes. I think we're so busy that busyness becomes addictive, and we manufacture busyness because it's so easy to confuse activity with results. Management disciplines like the ones I propose in the Smart Way model simplify the workload. So during the process in which you're learning how to do whatever the methodology is, while you're continuing to all, you have one foot in two camps. You're continuing to do your work the old way, and you're gradually, and hopefully not so tediously, transitioning to a new, more uncluttered, clearer, simplified approach, and you actually end up working less. you have less excuse to be busy for the sake of being busy, because busy feels good, which is why it's addictive. And it's so easy to find yourself spinning like a top and getting to the point where you confuse the filing of one piece of paper that's been sitting on your desk for a week with the same level of priority as getting in touch with the major donor who's trembling on the brink of saying yes. Now, which of those two is really more important? Trick question, right? I've come to believe, and I suffer from it in my own business, it's so easy to be pointlessly busy and wear yourself out, and so challenging to move a lower priority, urgent but not important stuff aside for a moment and look at what's really strategic. And this applies more to people in income generating disciplines almost than anybody else, because we do have a lot of plates to keep spinning at any given point. So
you're speaking my language. And again, as former salespeople, you know, when we were, maybe you probably were, or I was always straight commission sales guy, and it was a different mindset because it was, you had no choice. I need to make a certain amount of money.
No sale, no food.
Right? Yeah. And then when you come into the fundraising space, it is different. And it's easier to, I'm a registered as a fundraising solicitor in a couple states for a couple clients. So I
Same here.
You know, doing contract work then for clients. And as a, obviously we want to get the best results we can for our clients, but it's still having that monthly fee that we're charging our clients versus, now if the client said, we're not paying you unless you bring in X amount of dollars, right?
Right.
Different mindset. But the point, right. I'm to your point, is it is easy. We're all, again, hardworking, well-intended people, and we want what's best. And you know, like I do, coming from sales to the fundraising space, they're just, most people in fundraising are just so kind-hearted, well-intended. We have plenty of clients who were in the for-profit space and wanted to do more meaningful work and took a big pay cut to do this work.
Right.
So, you know, it's, maybe I'm too empathetic sometimes, but
let me just tell you, my happiest years as a salesperson and my most productive years were when I was working for a company that no longer exists, that had it was the only company I have ever worked for or even heard of, and it was a Fortune 50 company that had a salaried, non-commissioned sales force. Mm. And it was a lot more like a fundraising environment, because we were expected to and encouraged to develop relationships with our clients and truly understand their businesses. And I've taken away from that, and I fell madly in love with the nonprofit sector when I first started to explore it, the recognition that the work was meaningful, that the donors didn't have personal gain in mind. They had the satisfaction of their social conscience, their desire to right wrongs, and make social, you know, create social benefit. That was thrilling to me. But the fact is, we still have to somehow help our fundraising professionals overcome their reluctance to ask, overcome their reluctance to engage, be able to tell the difference between a donor who's so likely to give that it justifies the investment of that fundraiser's scarce and precious time, and the opportunity to spend lots of time with somebody who's real nice and happy to have you buy them lunch, but really doesn't have the potential for high lifetime donor potential.
That's a great segue to what the main thing we wanted to cover, because there is a lot. And provided you're really good on this podcast, maybe I'll invite you to come back.
Oh, please, sir. No, but I have some more.
we can do some more, and we have plenty of content to do more, and sure we will do more podcasts. And so we talked about, you know, what one main point can we talk about today? And I love this one, and it gets back to what we've been talking about. Is this sometimes I have as a sales guy and business owner, always had I think what's driven me is the scarcity mindset and always feeling like I need to do more. I need to do more. What if it all goes away? And so I'll just talk to anybody, and people used to say, what's a good client look like for you, Joe? And I would say, well, you know, it was a organization that's been around for at least 10 years. They have at least 2,500 active donors. They have at least two or three frontline fundraisers. And then I had somebody challenge me on that. And I said, what about the people you're working with? And like, you're right. I want somebody that's collaborative, somebody that's accountable, somebody that will do the work, right? So it's
and who are you talking to? Oh, this person who saw that you do fundraising consulting and has no money at all, and their nonprofit, the ink's still wet on their 501c3.
Right. So it's just like people are qualifying us. We need to qualify people that we're working with. And you so eloquently in your work and in the book and your content talk about, are your donors good enough for you? And do we, and I love this, and I always encourage clients, what's our IDP or ideal donor profile? So it's not just, this woman has a lot of money. She's a business owner. She's a very successful realtor. And she...
And a board member knows her husband and they owe him a favor.
Yeah.
Right.
But she doesn't return my phone calls. I've been chasing her. I've left her 5 voicemails and 3 emails. And she keeps saying, yeah, I want to talk, call me back. It's Labor Day. Labor Day, right? It's crazy. September's crazy. Call me in
October. I'm going to Italy. Oh, right? I can't go because I had to take the dog to the vet. I know these stories.
So you outlined a couple great, I love the rule of threes, the power of threes, and you outlined 3. If it's okay, I'll give you points and let you pontificate on these. So the first, top 3 key points. Why having an ideal donor profile simplifies everything that we do in fundraising? Why is that so important, or simplifying?
This is really a powerful issue. So I want to start spinning on the phrase I used, are your donors good enough for you? There's a really bad tendency to talk to people who'll give you the time of day, whether those donors are right for you or not. You just described it. And to chase after that person who says, yeah, for sure, I'm busy for a year and a half. So I know we all have this tendency to do what you just described. Take anybody who'll, pursue anybody who's willing to talk to us. And I looked at it and I said, what if we flipped this inside out? Because when we're attempting to raise money, when we're attempting to persuade somebody to do something for us, we tend to put on the mindset, what can I do to make them like me? How do I prove that I'm good enough for them? Or I should say that we, our organization, are good enough for them. When the real question is this prospect going to demonstrate the kind of passion for our mission, willingness to engage with us, ability to evangelize on our behalf, recognition that they have some kind of experience with or care about our mission, and so on and so forth. In other words, are their motivations for giving in alignment with what our organization is putting out there in terms of vision, mission, and programming? If that engagement isn't there, regardless of the donor's capacity to give, nothing happens. So we spend a lot of time with our clients helping them figure out 2 things. what's our value added? In other words, in selling terms, we might refer to that as the unique value proposition, or the elevator pitch, or the big message. What do we do that's really attractive to donors and to clients and to board members? So that's our value added. Then we want to look at our ideal donor. The best way to do this is if you already have a base of donors and you think through, which donors would I like to clone? And you can do a Frankenstein. You know, I'd like to clone Fred because of his passion and Mary because of her history of activism and Fran because of her giving history, and smoosh them all together and we've got the ideal profile. And that ideal profile is great for us for all of our messaging. Everything we say to the marketplace, to our current donors, prospective donors, and so on, has to appeal to people who already want us. They just don't know it yet. If that makes any sense to you.
Yeah. So is it all our messaging should appeal to our ideal client, ideal donor profile?
Yes, indeed it is. Even if that donor, let's say our messaging strikes the heart of a recent college graduate who's in their first job and is, you know, actually kind of in the gig economy and not earning a lot of money. If they have the sense of volunteerism and social conscience, and they can be our fan and our advocate, and maybe they're able to give a small amount of money, we want that. We want them. And we want the people who can give at the mid-level, and we, of course, want the people at the major and transformational levels. But anyone who becomes stakeholder, I don't know what term to use, should share the same motivations. Why is, you know, fill in the blank, important to them? If it's not really important, they're not going to do it for a long time. They're just not. Yeah. So it all revolves, all your messaging revolves around this ideal profile. Now, there may be more than one ideal profile. We had a client once who had an ideal profile for any, you know, for the individual donor and the corporate sponsor. But because of the nature of their projects and the nature of their value added, they actually had a specialized profile for celebrities. So there were, and in our case, that we include the motivations for giving are the single most important stuff, and that's not stuff you can get out of prospect research. That's stuff you can only get by changing the way you interact with the donors you already have, who you want to, you know, duplicate, reproduce, yes, clone.
So can you give a couple, two, three indicators or types of information that an ideal profile, donor profile should include?
Yes. I'm going to give you a couple of examples from the case study, which is hypothetical, that we use in our work when we're training people in this model. We call it the Smart Way Prospect Scorecard. It's an instrument that we build, you know, we help our clients build. And it's based on a botanical garden that has an ideal donor profile for people who are passionate about gardening. P.S. Not all botanical gardens really care about gardeners, but we use that in this instance. So some of those criteria were, the donor is passionate about seeing future generations engaged in gardening. The donor is a master gardener. The donor volunteers at community gardens and botanical gardens. So those are a few examples of motivations for giving. And we score them two ways. How important is it to your organization that you see this characteristic in a prospective donor? And how closely does the donor match? You multiply those two numbers. They're on a 1 to 5 scale, with 5 being the best. And then you give them a rank. If they're a really good match to those 3, 4, 5 criteria, it's probably worth it to pursue them, especially if they've got the right capacity.
So you have a scoring system, of course.
Correct, which really is a nice way to segment your donors. And one of the reasons this ability is useful, the ability to segment your donors, is that you, the fundraiser, your immediate supervisor, senior leadership, and the board really want to be able to look and say, Joe, you're spending an awful lot of time with C and D ranked donors. It's time for us to coach you a little bit, because the donors that come out with a low rank are not only less likely to demonstrate their engagement, financial and otherwise, they cost more to acquire. We spend more time and more hassle cultivating poorly qualified donors than we do qualifying donors that are very well qualified.
And I don't see a lot of clear, I don't see much clarity around what's the process. How many, a simple example, how many times am I going to reach out to this donor? How many, like we said earlier, they keep telling me each month there's something else going on. How long am I going to do that? So if let's say they fit our ideal prospect or A rated prospects, but we are just chasing and chasing and chasing.
Well, this is important. This scorecard that we devise has three categories of criteria. What are their values? You know, their motivations for giving. What's their giving capacity? And what are their danger signs? One of the clearest danger signs, a danger sign is, you know, you're an organization running after climate change, and you find out the donor thinks climate change is a hoax. Let's stop wasting our time on that donor. So one of the indicators that we often see pop up here is prospect is non-responsive. How many times are you going to ask Jane Doe for that meeting and have her give you some kind of excuse? This is your classic polite way of saying, I'm not really interested.
But I don't know how to say that to you.
So what you do is you stop. And there, you just bought back several minutes of time and more calories expended on frustration. And you're not quite as busy because you felt safe saying, she's not really going to respond. I've got adequate proof here. She's not going to respond. And you keep her on your mailing list because, hey, if she comes to your events, she gives to your crowdfunding things, she responds to emergency triggers of one sort or another, fine. Don't expect more.
It's so hard to let go of those, though.
Yeah,
they said they were interested. They were so excited. They couldn't wait to meet with me. I can't let go.
Oh, honey, get over yourself.
So, you know, and again, in my business, and we're the eternal students, hopefully.
Right.
As they get older, it's like, I have a new thing that I'm done chasing. Mm-hmm. This is on the business side. I'm done chasing people. I spent so much time chasing people that were just like, this is great. Oh, you rock, man. Let's do it. And then
you mentioned dollars.
I'll get a signature. Let me get the board. I just got to get my board chair to approve it. This is great. 6 months go by, 9 months go by, 12 months. And it's just like you're hanging on.
Well,
it's just wasted. Yeah, like you said, it's wasted time and emotional energy that I could be spending more positive energy on my clients and donors, people that
frankly, one of the things we ought to be spending some of our emotional energy on is sitting down and gazing at the, you know, leaves blowing in the trees. a little time to rest, time to reflect, time to do nothing. God forbid, time to analyze the records of your that you're keeping on your donors and say, you know, something's wrong. I'm not getting through. Is it the message? Does this person really fit, as a colleague likes to call it? Does this prospect really fit our funny shaped door? If they can't fit within our funny shaped door, they might be able to fit within somebody else's funny shaped door. Now, from a business perspective, we've started to be more and more rigorous about saying to clients, we're not really in a position to help you. So we're going to recommend you talk to fill in the blank consultant that we've already pre-qualified. We'll work with clients in that situation. And let me tell you, it feels really good. So is the donor good enough for you? Goes back to this. Is this a donor who wants to work with you, who is inspired by your mission? Or is it do me a favor fundraising, which it really drives me nuts? Yeah, I'll do you a favor. This is something we often find in board fundraising.
Yes.
And I think we are doing our boards a grave disservice when we fail to share with them this notion that it's not a matter of twisting somebody's arm so that you'll get them to serve on your board, or you promise them some other, you know, a contract, an arranged marriage. I don't care what it is. But it's like, look, I'm passionate about this organization. This is why I serve on its board. What do you think? Oh, not interested? Wonderful. Let's part friends. Oh, you don't like to give to charity in the first place? You think philanthropy is a scam? But whatever you think, there's a way to teach our volunteers and board members the same concepts I'm sharing with you. Because we don't want to frustrate them either. We don't want them to feel awkward bugging their family and friends, who after a while get turned off, like you're trying to hustle multi-level marketing stuff to them. And they sort of cringe when they see you coming. There's a lot of science to this. There's also a great deal of art. But the science part, having these criteria, setting up, teaching people the art of the probing question, and helping them keep track of what worked and what didn't work. That stuff really facilitates a change in people's habits.
Beautifully said, and a good transition to conclusion here. Sadly, we have to wrap it up.
I know, it just flew by.
I know, it does.
Probably because I blab so much. Sorry.
No, not at all. No, don't. Please don't apologize. You've passed the test. I'd love to have you come back.
My pleasure.
Love to have do more of these. You've got lots. Like I said, there's so much here. So can we maybe just kind of give them a couple quick takeaways?
Yeah. Ask yourself whether the client's good enough for you. Give yourself, your agency, your nonprofit, and your mission pride of place in your thought process, and stop worrying about whether or not you're good enough for them. And ask, why do you give to charity in the first place? You know, what really turns you on? What inspires you?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And so again, so people get in touch. Well, there's a lot of things, right? So you have the book, and that is Fundraising the Smart Way.
And it's available on Amazon in hard copy, very snazzy, and in Kindle version. And people can come to our website, bristolstrategygroup.com. And we've got a lot of stuff about Fundraising the Smart Way scattered all over the website, because that's pretty much the only thing we do.
And you have that great assessment called the Leaky Bucket Assessment.
The Leaky Bucket Assessment is so much fun. Anybody can take it for free. And you'll find a listing of it on our website. And the most recent roll-up of the data is on a slider on our homepage. It's really interesting stuff about the kinds of disciplines that are omnipresent in the sales world and largely lacking in the fundraising sector. Take it, everybody. We always want more.
Yeah. And you, are you available to speak? Do you travel the country speaking?
I do as much speaking as I can. I hate to travel.
Yeah.
So I do everything from by virtual means. And we just are starting a new webinar series. And you can find it on the website.
And just to, it's Bristol Strategy Group. Make sure you put group in there because there's another Bristol Strategy.
Yeah. Correct.
And then, of course, you help people directly, right? Obviously, your business is contracting with organizations.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And you can find, you can schedule a call with me. There's a million forms. We're trying to make it easy for people to ask questions, get information, get in contact with us and experience our work. So,
and great work it is indeed.
Well, thank you, Joe. That's a really nice compliment. I appreciate it. And I will look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, we'll do another one. Cool. Colin Bristol, thank you so much. Until next time.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.